situation was mostly contrived. It came under the pressure of the United States. We know for a fact that the Emiratis were not happy with the terms of the reconciliation. I mean, they're not necessarily opposed to reconciliation in principle, but they're not on board in terms of how it's happened and so quickly. The Saudis, of course, are. And I don't envisage it will last very long, because the differences between Qatar and the UAE and Saudi are quite profound. And of course, on top of all that, you have, you know, economic incentives. Qatar is going to be a competitor to these countries, especially taking into account that Qatar has gone deeper in terms of attracting intellectual capital. They've tried to transform themselves into a global hub for culture, movies,
and sports. With the
exactly. I mean, just look at the Qatar Foundation. It's involved in all manner of intellectual endeavors around the world. So huge divides between these states. So yeah, the blockade has been lifted, but you know, it's going to be a very rocky ride.
Sure, yeah, we'll find out sooner than later, hopefully. Okay, thanks to Mahana, Mr. Razaei there. We'll be seeing them again after our final report later in the show. Now, we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. The conversation continues. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Atwayi. Time now to look at a deeper picture in our in-depth section. The year 2020 saw the United Arab Emirates become the world's third largest buyer of gold, with the Turkish central bank leading the way on 41 tons of gold, followed by Russia at 19 tons, with the UAE scooping up 5.9 tons of the precious metal. The UAE made its entire 5.9 tons purchase in the month of January. Now, of the other Persian Gulf states, only the Saudis and the Qataris bought gold, with 100 kilograms going to Saudi Arabia and 1.6 tons going to Doha, which all was incidentally sold the same year. No other Persian Gulf states purchased any of the valuable metal. So why is the UAE buying so much gold? Well, according to a Reuters article, billions of dollars of gold is being smuggled out of Africa through the UAE, with customs data showing the UAE imported $15.1 billion worth from Africa in the year 2016, and that is a figure that has risen rapidly over the last 4 years. One of the main reasons for this is a tax avoidance scheme, with no taxes being paid to the states that produce them, allowing Western final users of the product being able to buy black market gold from a third party, in this case the UAE, without the notion of it being directly tied to child labor, conflict, or exploitation, hence essentially allowing a gold laundering operation to take place, with the UAE to be the facilitator. Well, let's now take a look at our final report of the show, which assesses the exploitation of labor in the UAE.
According to the International Labour Organization, there are some 146,000 female domestic workers living and working in the United Arab Emirates, many of them from the Far East, such as the Philippines, as well as Africa. As the cities of Dubai and Abu Dhabi soar into the skies with the world's most lavish and luxury buildings, the hidden workforce behind the glitz and glamour are the ones who are forgotten and exploited. So twisted and unbalanced is the law that all migrant workers in the UAE are tied to their employers to remain in the country under a system known as the kafala rule. For domestic workers in particular, this means that they have less rights than other migrant workers and see the staff living in squalid conditions, being paid less than minimum wages, and in many cases see them being abused by their employers in a variety of ways, from physical, emotional, and unfortunately sexual abuse. Such is the extent of the problem, which is in essence nothing more than modern-day slavery. 30 US congressmen called on Mike Pompeo to raise the issue, coinciding with Human Rights Day in December. However, much like the issue with blood gold, the US have failed to bring the matter to notice, instead preferring to keep its strategically placed partner in the Persian Gulf happy and not spoiling the status quo, which so suits the Americans and, of course, the elite royals of the United Arab Emirates.
Back again is Masoud Razaei, Deputy Director of the Persian Gulf Studies Center, and our very own Mahan Abedin. Thanks again to both of you for being with us. Okay, Mr. Razaei, final question here. A clear abuse of workers in the UAE has been cited and recorded. Many laborers coming from the subcontinent, they are being exploited there to further their Emirati economy, obviously, and in particular their infrastructure there, construction in particular. Do you think that places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi are profiting at the expense of others and breaching human rights in the process?
The issue of human rights is subservient to the geopolitics of the region. In other words, in the western part of Asia and the Persian Gulf, we need to look at which country falls into what geopolitical aspect of the region. If it falls into the geopolitics of the West and the US in particular, then human rights issues are not even part of the equation. You can see that human rights for countries in the region has no connection to human rights in the US. No pressure is exerted on these regional countries. No boundaries have been set forth for them. I can tell you frankly that these regional countries can form terrorist groups, buy and sell their oil, give them money and weapons. Any type of transaction or money laundering can be done because they are US's allies and they can get away with it. This also serves a reason for the US to have a presence in the West Asia region. The West will not have the regional countries' human rights issues get in the way of their other dealing and won't let this affect their relationship. We obviously know that many countries in this region do not have nor follow human rights policies compatible with the West, and we can say they are worlds apart.
Okay, final question to you, Mohan. There is a huge economic divide, I don't know if you agree, between the elite ruling families in the UAE and across the Persian Gulf in some states, of Arab states, that is. Do you think that this status quo will change anytime in the near future with resistance mounting against the ruling families? We have seen instances of that.
Well, you know, people have talked about this for a long time, and one has to admit these ruling families have proved to be more resilient than people imagine. But again, the fissures are real. The divisions are very real. And what's been happening in the past decade has been very interesting, because up to that point, much of the dissent was economic in terms of, you know, the elites having access to everything in places like the UAE and Bahrain. Of course, there was a revolution in Bahrain in 2011 that was suppressed. Now, Bahrain, mind you, is a little bit different to the UAE because there's a sectarian dimension there. It's a ruling, the ruling Sunni family is a small minority, whereas the majority is Shia. But if you look at the UAE, a country that doesn't have that problem, in the past 10 years, they've had to deal with something they've never dealt before, and that's political opposition coming from their own people. And take into account that the majority of the population in the UAE are expats. Mm. The actual indigenous people are a minority. And how does the UAE deal with political dissent? It employs the most draconian measures: citizen deprivation, you know, throwing people out, freezing their life, basically, their bank accounts and everything. So it brings out the hammer to squash it. And the question now is, how sustainable is it? And if you look at Saudi Arabia, its problems are even bigger because they have huge political dissent. And the Saudi people have been quiet for a very long time. They're now also rising up and making big demands, from women wanting to drive, to civic rights, cultural rights. So yes, these ruling families have proven to be resilient up to now, but don't count on them surviving completely unscathed in the future.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate your input, Mohan Abedin, and of course our special guest, Deputy Director of the Persian Gulf Studies Center, Masoud Rezaei. Many thanks for your input. It has been painted as the oasis of the Persian Gulf, with an ultra-modern infrastructure, a tourist paradise, a transit hub, and a center for international business. But it seems that the golden glow surrounding the United Arab Emirates is fast becoming tarnished. With the revelation that the Emirate is being used as a gold laundering base, nations like the United Kingdom, like Switzerland, they are getting their hands on blood gold, whilst being able to distance themselves from the atrocious way in which the gold is exploited, essentially seeing Bern and London use Dubai and Abu Dhabi as their dirty laundry basket. That's about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to once again thank our guest, Masoud Azai, Deputy Director of the Persian Gulf Studies Center, and Mahan Abedin for being on the show. And on behalf of myself and the entire team here on Economic Divide, I'm Kaveh Taghavi. Looking forward to seeing you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. A study by the Balkans and Europe Policy Advisory Group published before the regional vaccination campaign started in December concluded that coronavirus conspiracy theories are believed by nearly 80% of citizens of the Western Balkan countries striving to join the European Union. It said about half of them will refuse to get vaccinated. Some theories say the virus isn't real or that it's a bioweapon created by the United States or its allies. Another popular story holds that Microsoft founder Bill Gates is using COVID-19 vaccines to implant microchips in the planet's 7 billion people. Similar trends have been seen in even some Eastern European Union countries. The article we're about to present you has been written jointly by Dusan Stojanovic and Jovana Gek under the heading Vaccine Skepticism Hurts East European Antivirus Efforts. The article has been taken from the Associated Press News Agency website. Vaccines from the West, Russia, or China, or none at all. That dilemma faces nations in southeastern Europe, where coronavirus vaccination campaigns are off to a slow start, overshadowed by heated political debates and conspiracy theories. In countries like the Czech Republic, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Romania, and Bulgaria, vaccine skeptics have included former presidents and even some doctors. Serbian tennis champion Novak Djokovic was among those who said he did not want to be forced to get inoculated. Some believe that the coronavirus is a hoax, or that vaccines could inject microchips into people have spread in the countries that were formerly under harsh communist rule. Those who once routinely underwent mass inoculations are deeply split over whether to get the vaccines at all. A recent Balkan study warned there is a direct link between support for conspiracy theories and skepticism towards vaccination. The report added, a majority across the region does not plan to take the vaccine, a ratio considerably lower than elsewhere in Europe, where a majority favors taking the vaccine. Only about 200,000 people applied for the vaccine in Serbia, a country of 7 million people, in the days after authorities opened the procedure. By contrast, 1 million Serbians signed up for the €100 on the first day the government offered the pandemic aid. Hoping to encourage vaccination, Serbian officials have gotten their shots on television. Yet they themselves have been split over whether to get the Western-made Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine or Russia's Sputnik vaccine. More divisions in a country that is formally seeking East European membership, but where many favor closer ties with Moscow. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić recently greeted a shipment of 1 million doses of the Chinese Sinopharm vaccine, saying he will receive a shot to show that it is safe. A recent headline of The Informer, a pro-government tabloid newspaper, read, Serbs prefer the Russian vaccine. Officials announced that 38% of those who have applied to take the shots favor the Russian vaccine, while 31% want the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. A rough division among pro-Russian and pro-Westerners in Serbia. In neighboring Bosnia-Herzegovina, a war-torn country that remains ethnically divided among Serbs, Bosniaks and Croats, politics also are a factor, as a Serb-run half appeared set to opt for the Russian vaccine, while the Bosniak-Croat part of the country likely will turn to the Western vaccine. Sasan Milovanovic, a 57-year-old real estate agent from Belgrade, sees all vaccines as part of the global manipulation of the pandemic. He said, people are locked up and they have no lives any longer and live in a state of hysteria and fear. Novak Djokovic has said he was against being forced to take a coronavirus vaccine in order to travel and compete, but was keeping his mind open about vaccination. The top-ranked tennis player Djokovic and his wife tested positive in June about a series of exhibition matches with zero social distancing that he organized in the Balkans. They and their foundation have donated €1 million to buy ventilators and other medical equipment for hospitals in Serbia. Meanwhile, the Serbian Health Ministry official Mirsad Jelek has described the vaccine response as satisfactory, but cautioned on the state-run RTS broadcaster that people in rural areas usually believe in conspiracy theories and that it is why we should talk to them and explain that the vaccine is the only way out of this situation. A study by the Balkans in Europe Policy Advisory Group, published before the regional vaccination campaign started in December, concluded that virus conspiracy theories are believed by nearly 80% of citizens of the Western Balkan countries striving to join the European Union. The report said about half of them will refuse to get vaccinated. Some theories say the virus isn't real or that it's a biological weapon created by the United States or its allies. Another popular story holds that Microsoft founder Bill Gates is using COVID-19 vaccines to implant microchips in the planet's 7 billion people. According to the Balkans think tank, a low level of information about the coronavirus and vaccines, distrust in governments and repeated assertions by authorities that their countries are besieged by foreigners helps explain the high prevalence of such beliefs. Similar trends have been seen even in some Eastern European Union countries. In Bulgaria, for example, widespread conspiracy theories hampered past efforts to deal with a measles outbreak. Surveys there suggested distrust of vaccination, and that remains high even as coronavirus cases keep rising in Bulgaria. A recent Gallup international opinion poll found that 30% of respondents want to get vaccinated, 46% will refuse to get vaccinated, and 24% are undecided. Bulgarian doctors have tried to change attitudes. Dr. Stefan Konstantinov, a former health minister, joked that people should be told neighboring Greece would close resorts to tourists who don't get vaccinated because this would guarantee that some 70% of the population would rush to get a jab. In the Czech Republic, where opinion surveys show that some 40% reject vaccination, protesters at a big rally against government virus restrictions in Prague demanded that vaccinations not be mandatory. Former President Václav Klaus, a fierce critic of the government's pandemic response, told the crowd that vaccines are not a solution. The 79-year-old Václav Klaus, who insists that people should get exposed to the virus to gain immunity, which experts reject, said, "They say that everything will be solved by a miracle vaccine," he added. "We have to say loud and clear that there is no such a thing. I'm not going to get vaccinated." Populist authorities in Hungary have taken a hard line against virus misinformation, but rejection of vaccines is still projected at about 30%. The Hungarian parliament passed emergency powers in March that allows authorities to prosecute anyone deemed to be inhibiting the successful defense against the coronavirus, including fear-mongering or spreading false news. At least two people who criticized the government's response to the pandemic on social media have been arrested, but neither of them has been formally charged. Romanian Health Minister Vlad Voiculescu said he's relying on family doctors to inform, schedule and monitor people after the vaccine, and that his ministry will offer bonuses to medical workers based on the number of people that they get on board. Asked if such incentives would fuel anti-vaccination propaganda, the Romanian health minister, Vlad Voiculescu, said, "I'm interested more by the doctor's view on the matter than I am about the anti-vaxxers." Dr. Ivica Jeremic, who has worked with virus patients in Serbia since March and tested positive himself in November, hopes vaccination programs will gain speed once people overcome their fear of vaccination or their fear of unknown. He said, "People will realize the vaccine is the only way to return to normal life."
As more evidence comes to light as to just who was involved in the protests that saw five people die in the storming of the US Capitol building, it seems that many of those involved were serving or ex-military staff, raising the question as to just how right-wing the US actually leans. So serious is the situation that the Pentagon has launched a probe into extremist views from within the US military complex, as the body finally comes to terms and accepts that racism is rooted deep within the American system. Since the Pentagon has now acknowledged the problem, this raises the question as to whether the activities of those serving in the military and were part of the mob that broke into the Capitol actually broke more than just one law in the process.
Absolutely. In fact, these military officers that have been complicit, and it's not just the military, not just the Department of Defense, but also elected officials such as Senator Hawley, and also the police officers who we have seen on video leading these so-called insurrectionists into the Capitol, supporting them, taking photos with them. These are absolutely illegal and pose a big problem for the ruling class, because these people, these institutions, are the armed wing of the ruling class. They are there to protect the bourgeoisie. They are there to protect these elected officials and their rule of law.
However, the allegations are nothing new, as the US military has long been known to have racist views, as well as openly recruiting members of far-right or white supremacist groups. A report in the Guardian newspaper 6 months ago saw that the US military had already conducted a report into racism, showing that over a third of personnel had witnessed acts of racism in the service, a figure that's risen by some 14% since Trump took office. It also became apparent that many leaders within the white supremacists and far-right groups in the US were either serving or veterans of the US military, hence clearly linking the military-like discipline within such groups to the actual military body within the United States. Yet, as mentioned, this is nothing new, as the US has long displayed such traits. But what is apparent is the alarming and dramatic rise in such incidents, likely sparked by one very obvious catalyst. As Donald Trump finds himself ever more estranged from the grand old party and the presidency of the United States, his 4 years in the White House have left a legacy that no US president would be proud of, in particular when it comes to dealing with the diversity within his own nation. The endorsement of numerous acts of racial violence, discrimination and protest has left Trump leaving the White House having divided his nation. So many of his actions have actively encouraged and incited white supremacist groups to take a stand in the name of the so-called American Constitution. Trump also failed to deal with the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd by white police officers in Minneapolis. Had he done this promptly, it may just have given him another 4 years in the Oval Office. Trump has, in essence, created a divided and apartheid nation, something that incoming Joe Biden will no doubt have to reunite in his first term as president. However, with Trump very much still active in the background, the task is something that Biden must tackle head-on in order to resolve. With Trump having set the conditions to thrive, the question that now remains to be asked is whether Trump's legacy will lead to a civil or race war within the United States, whether he's in office or not.
Well, the empire is in decline, but it is not anywhere near ready to collapse. We might spend decades, we might spend maybe a year, but it will be time before the empire is collapsing and there will be those factions. The only future that the United States has is either a socialist one or a fascist one. And this battle will have to come eventually, but we're not anywhere near it yet. But the divisions are very deep.
Today I am calling on all Americans to...
Donald Trump has undoubtedly been the most controversial president of the United States. He has managed to make sworn enemies and inspire diehard supporters all across a divided America. His term in office is almost over now, but not the mixed feelings and fierce controversy surrounding the outgoing U.S. president. This week, Trump set a new record. He became the first ever American commander-in-chief to be impeached for a second time by the House of Representatives. Trump now faces trial in the Senate for allegedly inciting a group of his extremist supporters to violently attack Congress last week. In the worst possible scenario, he could be barred from ever holding public office again. That would practically mean the end of his political career. Back in 2019, Trump was impeached over his dealings with Ukraine, but finally acquitted by the Senate. This time, things could look a lot different, as a growing number of his fellow Republicans have said openly that the embattled president must be convicted. Trump has never been so isolated. Many members of his inner circle have either abandoned the lame duck president or seem to have distanced themselves from him. The outgoing president has also lost his cherished Twitter account, and many large corporations are boycotting him. Trump could be wiped off the face of U.S. politics, but his legacy will live on as dangerous divisions deepen in American society.
His main legacy for America is that he's the only president in the history, in American history, to have been impeached twice. He, through his mismanagement and his ignorance, he allowed the COVID-19 pandemic to ravage this country, to decimate the economy, and he's the worst president in American history.
400,000 small. This is expected to complicate things for Joe Biden from day one in office.
And we're in the middle of the once in several generations economic crisis.
The United States will soon have a new president. Joe Biden will take office in the coming days. His upcoming swearing-in ceremony will, however, be different from any past presidential inauguration, all thanks to Trump. Security concerns intensified over the past week. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are taking extraordinary measures to secure the ceremony in the capital of the nation. Authorities say they have received information indicating the possibility of more violence during the inauguration. The FBI, for instance, says armed protests are being planned all across America. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will be among the forces that will try to secure President-elect Joe Biden's swearing-in ceremony. Security forces say they want to prevent a repeat of last week's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The developments of the past weeks in the U.S. have raised serious questions about the credibility of American democracy. Was Biden democratically elected? Authorities have found no evidence of irregularities. So why does Trump still insist that the November election was stolen? And why do so many millions of Americans still believe what he says? Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections.
That's evidence that the experiment called democracy right now isn't working. The fact that, well, on the one hand, the fact that there, we expect there to be a orderly transition of government is a good thing. But what we have to go through to ensure that there is an orderly transition of government does not bode well for America.
Biden will probably try to improve the situation, but the divisions in the United States are too deep and cannot be mended overnight.
So tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward.
Many people around the world have highly condemned the brutal actions of the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine, whilst others have simply turned a blind eye to the actions of the regime, as it does not suit their foreign policy requirements. But when the criticism comes from within, surely it's time to take heed. In a piece in the UK Daily, The Guardian, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem director Shirai Elad slammed the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestine as apartheid control, which, coming from Israel's largest human rights group and a Jewish author, is something that has rocked Tel Aviv, who have quickly blunted the comments via its embassy spokesman in London, Ohad Zemet. Elad goes on to claim that the Israeli regime is working solely to advance the supremacy of one group of people, namely the Jews, which is most ironic, as the Jewish people themselves claim to have once been victims to such treatment, yet fail to back Elad's allegations when it's they who are at fault. So bad has the situation become, from the controlling of land and sea borders in Gaza to the endless slicing away of land in the West Bank, that Elad claims there's not a single square inch of territory where the notion of equality can be claimed between Palestinians and Jews, suggesting clear favoritism towards the Jewish people. With Israel about to enter its fourth election in just 2 years, the rights and voices of the people of Palestine are being suppressed, mostly through the calculated engineering of power by the Israeli regime against Palestinians, be it through political rights or pure and simple denial of rights. But it seems that the people of Palestine are not simply standing back and allowing the Israeli regime to quietly push them into a corner, with regular voices and demonstrations still taking place, opposing the so-called deal of the century, opposing the destruction of Palestinian homes, and opposing the Israeli regime's ongoing attempts to steal more and more Palestinian land. In spite of the United Nations outlawing the Israeli regime from continuing to destroy Palestinian lands and occupy more Palestinian land in the process, the Israeli regime has brazenly ignored the law, hence both undermining an international organization such as the UN and the rights of the people of Palestine in the process. In fact, since the start of 2020, the Israeli regime has demolished over 700 Palestinian buildings, ranging from homes, schools, medical centers, and community buildings, under the faux pretext of lacking construction permits, which is ironic, as they were all built on Palestinian land, hence raising the question as to just which Israeli regime permit could they possibly need. On top of the destruction of Palestinian homes and buildings, it's also the lives of the people of Palestine that the Israeli regime feels it so liberally able to take away. In 2020 alone, at least 27 Palestinian civilians were murdered in cold blood by the Israeli regime. Seven were children, proving that the execution of Palestinians is something that the Israeli regime is also getting away with scot-free. So poor and brazen is the behavior of the Israeli regime that now even Jewish settlers are taking things into their own hands, emulating the crimes of their regime by raiding and attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In fact, in 2020 alone, 248 attacks were committed by settlers, all of which have again gone unpunished and unnoticed across the international community. With the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and Arab nations such as Bahrain, the UAE, and Morocco, it seems that the voices of opposition are being deafened by the regime's false diplomacy, meaning that the people and land of Palestine is being wiped out by the Israelis, and equally as bad, being forgotten by their Arab brothers and sisters around the region. The Trump government enters its last day in office. Every effort is being taken by the White House and the State Department to divert attention away from its woeful behavior at home, and making sure that the international arena gets one last taste of Trumpism. The United States has introduced a fresh round of sanctions against the Yemeni Ansar Allah resistance movement, going as far as labeling the group as a designated terrorist organization. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated that he had declared three senior leaders of the movement as global terrorists, including Abdul Malik al-Houthi. However, it seems that by acting in this way, the US has done nothing to alleviate the ongoing war in the region, in particular when it comes to the terrible humanitarian disaster taking place in Yemen, which for the whole part sees the US and its regional allies wholly responsible for. With war raging on in the country, it seems that many people have forgotten about the disastrous impact on human life, with over 233,000 Yemenis dying from the impact of the conflict. It's hence why the Ansar Allah movement has highly condemned the actions of Mike Pompeo, as well as the lack of actions by the UN humanitarian team, who has failed to act, in essence, making them equally as guilty as the Americans for their lack of positive action. With very little to no humanitarian aid being able to enter the country, has the actions by Trump and Pompeo made things harder for life-saving drugs, equipment and medicine to reach the country. Although not all lives have been taken from the impact of the war, it's the connected impact that has hit Yemen the hardest, with many people, especially children, who are suffering the most, either through the lack of clean, potable drinking water, lack of fresh and healthy, nutritious food, and of course through lack of much-needed medical supplies, in particular as Yemen, like all other global nations, is facing a pandemic that knows no borders. When it comes to Yemen, the relentless campaign by the Saudi regime has caused a terrible loss of life and economic infrastructure to the country. Yet, every fire is being fueled from somewhere, and it's the United States that are fanning the flames in this case. In fact, in a similar last-minute action by the US on designating the Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group, the US has also struck a last-second deal to supply the Saudi regime with $290 million worth of arms, most of which, again, will be used in the war against Yemen, whilst at the same time funding the US military complex with the same brushstroke. But it's not just the Saudi regime that's guilty of crimes against Yemen. Its regional partner, the United Arab Emirates, is also embroiled in the war, and much like its neighbour in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi has also enjoyed the support of the US arms industry, securing a $23 billion arms deal with Washington, signed and sealed by none other than Donald J. Trump. With over 3,000 children killed since 2015 in Yemen, over 5,600 injured, and many more being added to the list on a monthly basis, why then are the people of Yemen being sanctioned and punished, yet those responsible for the atrocities are being rewarded by the US? With Trump having promised to end endless wars, why then does he continue to fund his regional allies, allowing the US to continue its global conflicts via its proxies? And will the arrival of a new US president spell any notion of change in US foreign policy, allowing the likes of Yemen to rise from the ashes and fight the humanitarian disaster that struck this ancient land?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Currently, the American people are the greatest enemy to the U.S. regime. This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
We have a strategic depth in the region on the basis of which many regional nations and governments support and love us and are willing to work in favor of our goals. However, the Americans say that we should abandon them. This is what the U.S. wants from us. Abandoning these privileges will not make him retreat, though. When you agree to reduce your defense capabilities, to destroy your own regional power, and completely forget about your nuclear industry, which is vital for your country, he will not become satisfied and will demand another thing and will make another request. No sensible man is willing to fulfill a transgressor's requests in order to make him stop.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Notice that under the influence of the enemy's propaganda, some people unfortunately say, "What is the use of nuclear energy for us?" There are some people who write these things in newspapers and other media. I have said before that nuclear energy is a definite need for the future of our country. In a few years, we will be needing at least 20,000 to 30,000 megawatts of electricity generated by nuclear energy. We cannot obtain this otherwise, and the other methods are not economically reasonable. Well, what should we do the day when we need it? Whose door should we go and knock on? Should we go and beg the U.S. and European countries to give us nuclear electricity or develop the enrichment process? Will they do that? Today, we should think about tomorrow.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the World with Reporters. Health systems in the EU are buckling under pressure from new coronavirus cases resulting from the holiday period. New variants are raising concern. Businesses remain closed. These have been identified as major challenges for the Portuguese government, which has just taken over the rotating presidency of the EU.
One of the first priorities is vaccination. Vaccination is the light at the end of the tunnel of this pandemic.
Critics say vaccination should currently be the only priority for EU authorities. The UK is approving jabs weeks ahead of the 27-country bloc,
Secrecy surrounds the number of vaccines going to each EU nation and how many people have so far received the jab. The European Commission says it is working with the European Centre for Disease Control to set up an information website.
And that cannot happen soon enough because a major criticism of the vaccination programme in the EU relates to a lack of data. It is simply impossible to scrutinise or compare the performances of member states.
We have been talking to EU citizens in Brussels about the speed of the vaccine's rollout.
My father is 76. I don't know where it will be for him. It will be maybe in 4 or 5 months. That's quite slow.
It's not easy, yeah. It's too slow. I think the priorities are not the best one.
Trying to understand why it's so slow in EU. I don't know, maybe we need more testing to be sure of the vaccine.
Me, I really want to live like a normal person, like the way we did. So if I have to be vaccinated, I will be vaccinated.
Cracks continue to appear within the EU's unity as countries move to secure vaccines independently of the European Commission. Adding to the woes is news that production of the Pfizer vaccine is being temporarily delayed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of people, including leaders and supporters of the far right, take to the streets of Vienna to protest against COVID restrictions.
This isn't the first protest of its kind here in Austria, and it comes as the country is in its third lockdown. That lockdown is expected to end on the 24th of January.
With hardly any masks in sight and no distance between them, demonstrators only booed and whistled when asked by the police to observe the safety rules. Many of the banners, signs and slogans repeated claims that the pandemic was part of a conspiracy in which the World Health Organization and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates were complicit.
You're not worried about contracting the virus?
I'm not worried about the virus because it's not dangerous for 99.9% of the population. It's not dangerous. It's just dangerous for very old, very sick people. And yes, for these people, influenza too is dangerous. And COVID-19 is not more dangerous than influenza.
These claims have been strongly refuted by experts who cite evidence-based data to prove that COVID is far more deadly and significantly more contagious than seasonal flu. In fact, with the emergence of new variants, experts believe we're now in the most dangerous time of the pandemic. Demonstrators also shouted slogans against the government's vaccination program that's already well underway.
The people should decide for ourselves, yes. And not because the law is decided for us. We want to decide, is this our body, is this our brain, our life, and not the life of the government.
With the rate of new infections still considered way too high, the government is expected to announce a further tightening of restrictions. Omar Lezgi, Vienna.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Britons have been sent home by struggling businesses and employers to sit it out. To prevent a spike in redundancies and mass unemployment, the government has introduced a furlough scheme to pay 80% of their wages up to £2,500 a month. In August 2020, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme revived the hospitality industry a little, and businesses have been offered grants to keep their heads above water until spring. But many might be wondering where all this money is coming from. The truth is, the Bank of England is using quantitative easing to keep government borrowing costs down. In other words, the bank is printing money for the government to spend. The adverse effects of the Bank of England printing more than £450 billion to get the country out of the COVID-19 crisis will be felt in the very near future and by ordinary working people, because most of this money will invariably end up in the pockets of the rich and influential, and very little will trickle down. Whereas before, money flowed in a circular fashion in the economy, with ordinary workers paying mortgages and bills to property and business owners, who went on to spend that money on more assets and living the life, money is now flowing on a straight line from the Bank of England, where it's being printed, into the pockets of ordinary working people and then into the pockets of the rich. By the end of the 2020 to 2021 financial year, the UK is expected to set the highest recorded level of borrowing in peacetime history.
The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs. And so you're looking at something where the moment is a sort of the pumping of the money is keeping the thing alive. But as soon as you start ending these programs, the realities of a collapsing economy, not just in the UK, the yellow vests, Brexit and Trump are all the result of a fundamental insecurities going on right the way across.
After the pandemic, the rich will go on to buy more stocks and bonds and property, and the surplus money in the economy will lead to its devaluation, pushing ordinary people with fixed salaries further down the economic ladder. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Italy topped 1 million COVID jabs since the start of the vaccination campaign on December 31st. According to the latest data, out of over 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine delivered across the country since December 27, more than 60% have already been injected, the highest number of first doses administered in the EU. However, some Italian media have been warning in recent days about an increasing number of medics and health workers not willing to be vaccinated.
Vaccination rate among health workers is quite high, however, about 10% of medical staff remain very skeptical. The lack of testing is one of people's main concerns. We are observing the effects of the vaccine while it's being administered.
A poll released in mid-December caused surprise in Italy by showing that one-third of the population were not willing to be vaccinated, along with half of nurses and other health workers.
I have my reservations over the vaccine because the matter has not been discussed much yet. I would have injected only if it becomes obligatory.
New polls are showing the scenario seems to have changed in recent days, with more Italians willing to receive the coronavirus vaccine. Medics promoting anti-vaccination propaganda had been warned or disciplined by doctors' associations.
Doctors' guilds in Italy have been conducting inquiries into medics accused of unwarranted criticism of vaccinations. Tens of medics have been punished with measures ranging from warnings to two-month suspensions.
Doctors' guilds' actions being timely and appropriate. Unfortunately, some medics should be trained on how to express their views on social platforms as they aren't aware of the consequences of their inflammatory posts.
Meanwhile, a joint report by the Health Ministry and the Higher Health Institute is warning the COVID-19 epidemic in Italy risks becoming uncontrolled as the virus RT reproduction number has been increasing for 5 weeks straight. The country's COVID-19 death toll has risen to over 81,000. Max Civili, Rome.
Across the United States, local newspapers are running the same headlines. A record-breaking year in murders. Not since the ruinous crack cocaine epidemic have poor areas been so culturally and emotionally devastated by violence. The coronavirus lockdowns in the United States were widely criticized for being enacted without any apparent consideration as to how it would affect their lower classes. Adding lockdowns on top of bad housing, lack of access to food, police brutality, and other endemic problems put unbearable stress on those who could least afford it. The tremendous economic suffering also decreased the revenue of America's rampant gang activity, which many allege is aided by corrupt cops, and sparked increased fighting over market share. But Chicago, the nation's third largest city, is indicative. Almost half of all shootings here took place in just 7% of neighborhoods which are dominated by poor African and Latino Americans. These areas don't just lack schools, jobs, and health care, they even lack sidewalks and garbage cans, because both private banks and the government refuse to make even basic investments.
The solutions remain what they have always been. The solutions remain investment into neighborhoods. The solutions remain accepting authentic leadership that people will listen to, because these leaders have the best interest of the people in mind